Hello and welcome to episode 9 of series 2 of the Agent's Hope podcast. My name is Tim Cox. I'm your host. I'm an educational psychologist who works in the northeast of England. I'm really, really happy today to be inviting and speaking to our first guests who work in Scotland. So I've got Fran and Larissa on to me, and we're going to be talking about their work around nurture. But before I go too much into that, I'll let Fran and Larissa introduce themselves and you know, I guess my first question, as always with most of my guests, is kind of what's brought you to psychology before we get into kind of what we're working on now? What's kind of your backstory and how did you get here?
Thank you, Tim. So my background is originally in primary education, primary school teaching, and following my undergraduate psychology degree, I completed a postgraduate training route in Dundee and taught in Dundee and Angus in the northeast of Scotland for a few years. And then I completed my doctorate in Southampton between 2012 and 2015. And I've practiced in Glasgow since this time. So that's now unbelievably coming up for 7 years. But during that time, I actually attended a national conference where one of my colleagues was presenting on the Nurturing City, which actually coincided with the development of Glasgow's policy for towards the Nurturing City, which we can talk a little bit more about today. But this really inspired me to work in the city, and it just really related to all my professional interests. So thinking about whole school approaches, as well as trauma-informed and relational approaches to support inclusion. A key interest of mine is staff wellbeing, which was the focus of my doctoral thesis. And it's also part of the focus of what we've chosen to talk to you about today. So we'll hopefully share a bit more about that in a bit more detail. Also, I suppose, underpinning all of that, interest in research and supporting practitioner inquiry and professional development. So I'm involved in supporting trainees and new entrants to the profession, which is something that we're keen to support an understanding of nurture right across the workforce. And we do deliver training to our probationer teachers as well, once they join the Glasgow context. But coincidentally, be aware, Larissa and I both trained on the same initial course at Southampton for the doctorate, but our paths didn't actually cross until several years later in the Glasgow context. So a nice twist of fate there.
I know, and actually I remember, Fran, like you were third year and I was first year, and you were presenting your thesis at that scary thesis presentation that we had to do.
Seems like only yesterday.
Yeah, you were doing that, so then saw you and then obviously have joined you in Glasgow. So my background is a bit, so when I was doing my undergrad in psychology, I wasn't quite sure what path I wanted to take. I knew I didn't want to go down the clinical route. But then it was when I was in my third year and we had some kind of input around kind of education. And that really made me kind of think how I could use, I recognised that I was privileged with the education that I had had and experiences, but how could I use that to kind of make a difference for others? So I worked as a teaching assistant and a speech and language resource provision first, and then trained at Southampton between 2014 and 2017. And after that, I worked as an EP in Portsmouth for a couple of years. So I am familiar with working within the English system as well, and then relocated to Scotland in 2019 and joined the Nurturing City and be part of that. But actually it was only 6 months before lockdown hit. So I've actually done more of my practice in Glasgow under kind of COVID and lockdown, although we're obviously coming out of that the other side. But I've got a lot of Scottish family, so despite the English accent, I'm mostly Scottish. And my mum was actually born in Glasgow, so it's really nice to be back kind of in the Nurturing City and back where kind of like family have come from. So some of my professional interests are around kind of whole school nurture, relationship-based approaches to inclusion, and also the early years. And at the moment, we're doing some work on rolling out nurture within the early years. So it's combined both of those passions together. And I had also completed my thesis looking at the effect of nurture group intervention on children's social skills. So that was more around the kind of targeted nurture group. But being kind of up in Glasgow, I've really been able to support our kind of vision around whole school approaches to nurture, as well as having those more targeted supports, but at the kind of more universal level. So yeah, that's a bit of background about me. But yeah, we're really excited to be here today and to be having the chat with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very excited to have you on. And actually, I think, although I've not kind of worked in Scotland, I think actually my introduction to educational psychology largely came through nurture group training when I was working in a pupil referral unit in Newport in South Wales. And I'm pretty sure that the Glasgow approach was heavily referenced as part of that 3-day training, and it actually kind of it was the gateway to psychology for me, really, to understand the work that I was doing in a different way, and in a way that kind of really inspired me to want to pursue it further, and I guess eventually led to me applying to do the course in Newcastle. And it sounds like, you know, that you've both kind of bounced between kind of, I guess, the kind of the belt of Scotland and the south coast of England. There's a large distance between those. So what was it about Glasgow that brought you both back there or to there?
I think it's probably helpful just to kind of reflect on the sort of national and the local context, really, because for those who aren't familiar, Scottish education does have a really key focus on wellbeing and relationship-based approaches, and that really underpins a lot of our policy and curricular landscape as well. So I think it's really important to highlight that. In terms of our national practice model, it's kind of thinking about thinking holistically about the needs of the child, so the role of nurture within that, I suppose, and the range of factors that might impact on children at any given time in their development, and really that ongoing vision, I suppose, that the headline is that we want to make Scotland the best place in the world for children and young people to grow up, and a real focus on supporting wellbeing in order to close the poverty-related attainment gap. Alongside that, we've also got significant investment from the Scottish Government in the National Trauma Training Plan. So we had an EP seconded from our service to develop a suite of professional learning resources. And that draws together the links, I suppose, between nurture, attachment theory and trauma-informed practice. So that's really key to all of our approaches. All of these kind of hang together, I suppose. But
yeah.
The local context, really, a little bit about our demographic, is that we do have some of the highest levels of deprivation and poverty in Scotland, and comparable to other councils, we're also one of the largest authorities, and we have a proportionately high number of children, young people who are care experienced. So that really feeds into the rationale, I suppose, of why nurture is so important in Glasgow. I don't know if you wanted to say anything, Larissa, about why. Like Glasgow, or
yeah, and I guess maybe similar to what Tim was saying when he was accessing that training and Glasgow being quite heavily referenced. So when I was working in England, that kind of knowledge around nurturing approaches within Glasgow, and actually the our kind of one of our old deputes who's now moved on to another authority, but I actually ended up referencing her in my thesis, and then she turned out to be my line manager. But there's been a lot of work, and I think Glasgow's really well known and a really progressive service in terms of nurturing approaches, and I think that kind of strategic element to it, and I guess, like Fran was saying, the fact that there's the support from the government level all the way down to the policies through education services, it feels like everybody's moving in the same direction in terms of that nurturing approach, which when we're thinking about kind of psychological services and that role within it, actually, if everybody's on the same page, it makes it, you know, it's not saying there aren't challenges and there aren't barriers, but it does help give a bit of not a head start, but like a way forward, because everybody
a shared approach,
a shared language, a shared vision, but drawing on everybody's kind of strengths or kind of areas of professional expertise. But we know we've kind of got the backing of like that wider partnership. And I guess I felt like coming up to Glasgow, I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be able to contribute to making a difference at a more strategic level. So that's really kind of, you know, was influential in my decision to relocate and to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was just going to say, I think for me, as I said, I taught within the Scottish education system, and that was my postgraduate training. So teaching in areas of deprivation as well. Previously, I suppose nurture always resonated with me and made me kind of make sense of a lot of my previous experiences in the classroom as a practitioner. And I suppose that, things that I wished I'd known then that would have supported my practice. Isn't there
that we always have in the training about, you know, you can't do the bloom until you've done the Maslow, you know, when we're thinking about kind of like the Maslow's hierarchy and the kind of, you know, basic needs and nurture, and then we can be focusing on kind of more curriculum and raising attainment and things. But if we don't get it right in terms of nurture, that's going to be quite tricky to achieve those kind of closing the attainment gap and kind of driving up academic standards.
And much like yourself, Tim, hearing and yourself, Larissa, in terms of referencing Glasgow, hearing, as I say, a former colleague present at a national conference in relation to attachment, attunement and Glasgow strategic vision was really the driver for me. Plus my husband is from Dundee, so that helped, making the links between my former teaching experience and then the psychology and bringing all of that together within a context that I felt was aligned with my professional values.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that sounds really exciting, but I guess I'm wary that we're all psychologists and there might be people that are really interested in nurture as an approach or education psychology as approach, but perhaps we should spend some time just kind of defining in a colloquial way what kind of nurture means and what it is, because some people might have different ideas about it, and you know, in the different schools that I've worked in, it's been taken differently, sometimes really positively, sometimes in quite a suspicious way, I guess. So could you just kind of help people to understand what nurture is?
Thanks. I think that's really important to acknowledge, and that's actually an activity we do with probationer New Start teachers when they have their first induction right at the beginning of their time within Glasgow, is to think, what does nurture mean to you? And that range of responses that we get is actually really interesting, just to throw that out in terms of associations. And often we find that people do make connections with attachment theory, supporting child development. But also, I suppose, as you say, there can be some misconceptions that it's not about high expectations as well. But obviously, we want to force that balance between support and care and challenge and warmth. And all of that kind of comes through our initial training. But I think that's really helpful to kind of acknowledge, as well as the distinction, which we touched on, between targeted and universal approaches. So Glasgow's journey started back in 2001. Glasgow started with an initial pilot in one primary school of a targeted nurture group. So for those who aren't aware, nurture groups were initially developed as an approach to supporting children who were perhaps believed to have missed some key early experiences which might impact on their ability to settle and respond in school. And that was established really by Marjorie Boxall, an educational psychologist in the 60s. In an inner city London borough, I think it was Hackney, as a means of bridging the gap between school and home and to try to recreate some of those early essential experiences, again through the importance of supportive relationships with key adults. So over time, that concept has evolved, I suppose, and that's really where our focus is now in terms of whole school approaches, because we know that targeted approaches can only be effective when they're embedded within a whole school nurturing ethos and climate, and all staff really share that understanding and commitment. I think another core kind of element of nurture is probably worth highlighting, the 6 nurturing principles. These really underpin the targeted nurture group approach, but also equally applicable when we're considering wider school initiatives at a whole establishment level. So those principles recognise the importance of the group or the classroom or the playroom as a secure base for young people. We always want to think of learning in terms of understanding that developmentally, so children's stage, not their chronological age, and that really informs our approach to planning and needs identification. Nurture is important for the development of well-being, and that applies equally to our learners, to our staff, and to our families and communities, which we hope to kind of capture as well today. The importance of language as a vital aspect of communication and how we understand people's needs, I suppose. I think I already referenced, I suppose, thinking about all behaviour being seen as communication, and that's really fundamental. Again, when I think back to my early teaching experiences in the classroom, we know the impact of poverty within our local context, and the research, it's well evidenced in terms of the impact of early adversity on later health and social outcomes. So we want to kind of view that through the lens of behaviour. I suppose it brings a more compassionate approach to understanding behaviour mm-hmm. as communication, and also the importance of transitions for all children and young people, and recognising multiple transitions in children's lives, especially with all the changes that we have experienced in society as a result of the pandemic. So these are the kind of six guiding principles that inform all of our work within Nurture, whether that's a targeted Nurture group or whether that is at a whole school level.
I think the other bit there is that lots of the research out there is in terms of Nurture, and particularly thinking back to when I was doing my thesis and things, there are lots that come from the Scottish context as well in terms of looking at Nurture groups and gathering that data over time. And I think if we're looking at that research, we know that Nurture works. So actually, when we look at outcomes, we look at kind of children's Boxall profile scores and, you know, ways of kind of measuring it. And I think now the kind of literature and research is starting to move towards, you know, broadening that out, because it's actually recognizing that Nurture benefits all children, and that there'll always be some that do need that additional targeted input. But again, it's like it has to be sat within that Nurture nest, you know, in terms of that whole school approach and that understanding. And I think there was lots of bits when I was kind of doing my literature review and things from a paper around like maybe some people viewing Nurture groups as like a tea and toast. So children were coming out for that tea and toast, and what was the kind of actual learning there. And I guess maybe also I did reflect quite heavily on my own thesis and the research I did, some of the outcomes that came out, particularly around children's feelings of belonging within the Nurture group versus back in, you know, within their mainstream classrooms. But actually, how effective, you know, we kind of know as psychologists in terms of interventions, how effective is that withdrawal approach from the context that children are in and sort of, you know, learning in with every day? And also we know about that difficulty, don't we, with generalizing skills learned in one context to another context. So even if we have Nurture groups and we know that they're working, but we haven't got classrooms that are also embedding that nurturing approach, when children then transition out of Nurture groups or they go back for the afternoon, because lots of schools will run their kind of groups in different ways based on their context, particularly around secondary schools, how can we support children to do those skills? And I think that's why that emphasis on whole school Nurture is really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I think I've experienced, because I think the Nurture group training sort of set me on fire with the passion for applying this psychology and this compassionate approach over time, and it's something that I think I tried to take to different schools that I was working in after that training. But I think what I found over time is that unless you're universally understanding children in this way, it's something different. You can't be just an island of Nurture. You know, you can have a nurturing approach and all of those sort of things, but trying to use the tools in a system that's not supporting that sort of development felt not necessarily disheartening, but it just felt like, oh, I need to change my approach. And I think this is something that working in the English system, which is to some extent largely traded system, and in a context which is focused highly on attainment and catch up rather than thinking about stage, not age, and all of those sort of things in the English system. It's something that I think this approach is still really relevant and perhaps even more relevant. I mean, last week I was at the DCP conference, which is about inclusion, diversity, and social justice. And, you know, the themes I took out of the sort of, I guess, problem-focused thinking is that we've got a system at the moment which is coming out of a pandemic, which has led to large-scale interrupted development for children, young people, and staff well-being, particularly. There is now this focus on academic catch-up, but there's a huge amount of social justice issues which have been highlighted and discussed heavily during the pandemic periods. And also, on top of that, we have kind of at a government level issues that have been highlighted with the statutory processes that we have not quite meeting the needs of the children, young people, and the families that we work with. And there is this sense of we need a systemic change, but we don't know where we would start. I guess the sort of the fact that somewhere within our own island is doing something differently. And I love that phrase that you said, you can't do the blooms until you've done the Maslow. That makes so much sense. And that is, I guess, a quote that I've been reaching for so many times in consultation.
As well, Tim, kind of reflecting on that and thinking, we know that the pandemic has kind of exacerbated lots of those social injustices, poverty, you know, children, young people's mental health issues that were already
prevalent
the pandemic. But we know across the UK and across, you know, various other countries as well. And I think the fact that, you know, it's, you know, reflecting now, it's 10 years since Glasgow developed its Towards the Nurturing City policy, and that's come from a strategic headquarters level, so guided. But actually, I think, you know, that it kind of left us really well placed in helping to respond to the pandemic, because, you know, there was lots of that panic, there was the issues around well-being, supporting staff, but actually the fact we had got so much nurture embedded, it was about needing to do more of the same. You know what you're doing, we know what works, we know what needs to continue. And I think absolutely there's still a focus here on, you know, needing to think about children's attainment and raising that. And I think those similarities between the two contexts, there's still that focus, but maybe the difference is how we get there. And I think the fact that actually we could go and do lots of reading interventions or spelling or catch up after school, but if children haven't had breakfast in the morning, they haven't got their uniform on, they haven't had a warm house to be in, they're not in a place to learn. So then there's no way that you're going to be able to improve their attainment. So actually, I think, you know, it's that drawing on the research and the experiences within Glasgow, we know that the nurture can work and can kind of drive towards that key national driver. And maybe that's something where it's slightly the other way around within the English system. From that, and maybe, you know, we're thinking about this as you know, that kind of opportunities for hope, and, you know, out of adversity there always come opportunities, and maybe it does provide an opportunity for authorities or for other governments to maybe think differently about, you know, how we could be supporting children and young people as we come out of the pandemic.
Presenting at the conference, I was talking about hope theory and how that can be applied. And within the reading that I did for that presentation, I was looking at attachment and hope theory and how those two things kind of go together and develop together. And I think some people's broad criticism of a nurturing approach is that it's a bit, you know, it's just a bit soft, it's a bit, you know, holding people and containing them and telling them it's okay and all of those sort of stuff. And that's what I guess what it can look like to people who don't understand what's going on and the importance of the secure base. But I guess the balance to the secure base is the secure base allows somebody to go off and explore, and secure base is developing agency about that exploratory behaviour. And then if they have the secure base, then they'll be able to develop what Snyder and Hope Theory would call pathway thinking towards goals. So actually having the secure base actually develops attainment over time. So it's good early intervention to be thinking about these.
That context for support and challenge. So it's, I guess it's thinking it's not, you know, that it's a compassionate approach to support and challenge in terms of we are supporting children, we are meeting them where they're at, recognising their developmental stage, you know, making sure that they've got those experiences. But it is also about providing that challenge within a safe, you know they've got a key adult, they know that relationships can be repaired. And those things, and giving them
perhaps that's not taken place elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I would build on what you've said, Larissa, in terms of the essence of nurture is about hope and resilience and recovery in the face of adversity. And that's taken on renewed importance, as you've said, Tim. And also, I think nurture really has been the foundation of our recovery process, despite that initial rug being pulled from under your feet.
Yeah, like rabbit in the headlights kind of moment.
Yeah, it's actually really supported and strengthened our response and our ability to adapt to those unforeseen circumstances. And whilst it is a bold ambition towards the nurturing city, you know, we're talking about nurturing individuals, establishments and communities. It's not happened overnight. There has been, as Larissa said, over a decade, approaching two decades of work around this. And it's really, we were reflecting seeing nurture not as an add-on, but to consider how, I suppose, if other authorities or contexts were kind of thinking about how to bring this to the fore, is about considering how it fits with our existing priorities, and that it's not something that can be done separately.
It's not like an approach that you kind of do nurture. So we're not coming out of class to do our 10 minutes of nurture. It's that kind of way of being, isn't it? And that coming through all the different levels. So, you know, all our schools, our early learning centres, you know, our colleges, our, you know, psychological services, the other agencies that we have, you know, all working together to support that.
But it really does rely on that shared understanding, which is perhaps something at this point in our journey we can take for granted. But we are keen to continue to support those core messages with new entrants to the profession, to teaching, etc. That all staff really do seem to be on board with nurture. And I don't feel that we are met with that resistance, perhaps in the past that would have been the case. I suppose it's making me think of other approaches that can support a nurturing ethos, such as restorative approaches, where some of those initial kind of mindset challenges, you can be met with some kind of suspicion from staff. There's a lot of parallels there, I suppose, with other kind of social and emotional well-being approaches. But it's really understanding the purpose of what we're doing, as you say, in terms of meeting children and young people, you know, where they are developmentally.
And it's a big approach, isn't it? So it is a commitment from establishments and from the authority as well, you know, to be committed to that. And I think as well, we, you know, there has been that focus on schools, and we also are thinking there's a focus on our early years, and, you know, early years at the moment as well, knowing that if we can get it right in the early years, that's how we can, you know, contribute towards making that biggest difference in that early intervention. And within our children's services plan, there's a commitment to being able to roll out nurture within the early years over the next couple of years. So having that kind of backing and commitment, you know, we recognise that position that we are in now, but it's taken those years of work, kind of evidence showing what's working, getting people on board, getting the right people in the room, you know, developing those policies to all be kind of moving along in that kind of direction.
Yeah, I mean,
current and former contributed to that evidence base and continue to do so, but as Larissa says, there's a lot of kind of supportive structures that uphold that. I don't know if it's helpful for me to sort of share some of that, Tim, or if
you
had any questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose in terms of where we are now and that vision towards the nurturing city, it is a commitment, as you say, Larissa, across the whole of education and children's services, not just psychological services. But we do want to share today a little bit about our kind of unique role in driving that strategic vision. But I think it's just highlighting the range of structures that kind of underpin and support the commitment as well. So internally within our psychological service, we have a Nurture City lead group, which both myself and Larissa are members of. And that's a key part of our strategic remit. So we do have, I suppose, a protected time commitment
to
drive
work.
Forward research, development. So that certainly supports our goals. We also have a wider Nurture steering group within education services, and a full-time seconded Nurture development officer. So that is an experienced senior EP promoted role, who links with education services to support the ongoing development of Nurture across the city. One of the key kind of focuses which we staff really respond well to and look forward to and anticipate, which we're planning currently, is the annual Nurture conference. So we do have a range of high profile keynote speakers and opportunities for psych services to contribute, I suppose, workshops and sharing good practice across early years primary and secondary, as well as the views and experiences of children and young people within that. And we also carry out an annual Nurture survey, which informs our ongoing evaluation. So that's sent out to all establishments, and we've just completed that cycle. But again, that identifies any needs across the city and what staff have valued and found supportive in their kind of professional development. And I've mentioned already all new probationer teachers in Glasgow and all new trainee educational psychologists are invited to introductory Nurture training, and that's delivered by EPs within the service as well. So I guess it's at all these levels. One other thing to highlight, probably as timely as well, is the kind of expansion of targeted Nurture, which started, as I say, with a pilot in 2001. We now have approximately 68 Nurture groups in primary settings, and about 20, we refer to them as Nurture corners in the early years, although I believe that's expanding, isn't it? Or with
that's,
a focus
that's changed more,
yeah,
to the whole,
changed more to whole school, whole establishment, and 14 Nurture bases within secondary establishments across the city. That was in 2021. But a few years ago, as you say, Larissa, it's really timely to be discussing this a decade on from the introduction of the Towards the Nurturing City policy. A few years ago in 2017, Glasgow also jointly developed the Applying Nurture as a Whole School Approach framework
with Education Scotland,
which is our national improvement agency. So again, a number of colleagues were instrumental in the development of that framework. And what that really did was establish a shared definition of nurturing approaches. And it provides schools with a framework, or schools and early years settings, with a framework for self-evaluation and implementation of Nurture according to the specific unique needs of their establishment. So again, that guidance came about really with the growing recognition that interventions can only be effective, as we say, when they're embedded within the wider school culture and ethos, that has those six nurturing principles at the core. So I'd really encourage people, I suppose, to have a look at that full framework, which is freely available to download from the Education Scotland website if you're looking for further information on the implementation and the evaluation. It includes lots of practical tools as well as quality indicators for staff reflection, self-evaluation, readiness checklists, and attunement and observation profiles to support your planning and evaluation, really. So Larissa's going to talk a little bit more about Glasgow's approach to embedding that and evaluating that.
Yeah, so I'll fire on with that, shall I? So I guess, you know, the kind of the role that's kind of sets the scene, but that what's that role of psychological services within that in helping to shape and support that strategic vision? So within our service priorities, Nurture continues to be a kind of core offer and a key area of focus for us, across consultation, training, research that comes within the city lead group, but also comes within, you know, casework that we might be doing at more of an individual level as well. And with, you know, it's been promoted as that key approach, and helping establishments to meet those key national drivers and the Scottish education priorities. But I think the thing for me as well that really stands out is, and using that framework, and people kind of describe it as their Nurture Bible, don't they, in terms of like the go-to booklet, is that real focus around kind of implementation science, implementation frameworks, and that self-evaluation kind of being at the core. And I guess if we're thinking about implementation science, you know, it's thinking about how we make interventions or, you know, approaches within that real life context and practical. And we know that as EPs as well, in terms of things that we might do in the research or studies that we've done, but how that actually translates to the school context, to the classroom, and what kind of other, I guess, enabling factors and maybe kind of barriers and challenges that we need to work through there. But it's also kind of got self-evaluation at the core there, in terms of really focusing and getting people to think about impact and outcomes. So what is it we want to do differently and see differently, and how are we going to get there, and how will we know? Because, you know, it's through that we kind of drive the cycle of kind of continual improvement with schools, and that kind of concept around self-evaluation is a key focus across Scottish education, in terms of, you know, triangulating data and, you know, school self-evaluating. It's something that our staff and, you know, within education, it's very familiar to them and kind of a key priority there, and links with our national improvement framework. And that really helps, I feel, to drive forward that nurturing approach. So part of the work that our psychological service has been done has been developing a nurture principles pathway for establishments. So this is really supporting them with the implementation of whole school nurture. So key parts of this, we're thinking about the implementation kind of frameworks of four different stages, thinking about that self-evaluation and needs analysis and how we can support schools with that. As our city lead group, we also develop training materials. So we have an awareness raising session around kind of nurturing approaches and covering some of those key messages from attachment theory. And we then also have developed core modules for each of the six nurturing principles as well, which we can kind of guide establishments through. And we tend to not offer one-off training. That's where the training is all embedded within that implementation plan. So also thinking in terms of drawing on kind of practitioner inquiry and some of that action research as part of the nurture principles, and getting staff to evaluate where they're at in terms of things that they're doing well in relation to that principle, and things that they might, you know, areas that they might want to develop, and being able to generate their own action plans. And then the EPs consult with staff to support them in terms of implementing those action plans and reviewing their kind of progress and journey with that. And then as part of that, schools are also collecting evaluation data in terms of their outcome measures, particularly thinking about kind of outcomes for staff and also children. So that's the kind of main piece of work that we've been doing in developing that pathway and supporting schools.
I think, Larissa, that's where I'm just thinking with my research hat on as well, because that's another of my strategic remits. It's that's where you get the buy-in. That's where you get the most buy-in from staff, isn't it? Where they can see the links and they are applying it, having opportunities to come together for shared reflection and making small changes within their environment, which don't have to be drastic. And again, the framework can really support staff to kind of pick out those features of effective practice. But I think it's the mindset bit again, isn't it? And the application and how we support and evidence that.
Yeah, and keeping it tailored to their context as well. So if they're going through that self-evaluation process and thinking about, you know, what they would like to see differently, but also building on their strengths, it's then making sure that training, that support for them, that kind of consultative role as an EP, also coming into the training, but also linking the research bit. So, you know, when we're thinking about kind of Currie's five core functions, actually they're all intertwined at that point in terms of supporting their implementation. And again, with that buy-in, they're wanting to make a difference and see the difference. So being able to kind of drive that forward. And then as with our part of our research role, some of those next stages now in terms of that is gathering data across the city from establishments in order to evidence impact of that whole school approach or approach within the early years as well, to be able to collect that data and that information.
It's also that collaborative element, isn't it? So thinking about implementation, you've mentioned that a lot, Larissa, sort of having a shared approach, so maybe a core team or a working group within an establishment, so that where there are changes in staff, perhaps somebody's driving it, but if they were to move on, the momentum isn't lost and it still remains a key focus on a school's improvement. plan, and there's still a collaborative approach to drive that forward, and with new staff too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, now, you know, we're still trying to build. We're as a service, we always are engaging in self-evaluation, and we're trying to improve in self-evaluation, you know, go through that same process as they are with their establishments. But I think with nurture, it's never something that's finished. There's always things to be kind of, you know, there's always something that we can be doing better, we can be doing differently, we can be thinking about. And whilst these that kind of rollout in the early years and developing our implementation plan for the nurture principle modules, and a lot of that work kind of dovetails with the work of our nurture development officer, who's providing some of that core training for nurture group staff, so our 4-day and 2-day training, plus lots of other different workshops and things that she does. It's linking together, and we've got some kind of ongoing pieces of work starting with rolling out that colleagues are involved in, to roll out nurturing approaches within children's houses, and also looking at within the kind of additional support for learning sector as well, and any tweaks, changes, adaptations that might be needed through consulting with stakeholders within those settings and with parents. So there's always, I think, bits to be doing differently and driving it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, although the idea of nurture is pretty easy, accessible to get on board with, is that what's been developed over the last 10 years in Glasgow is a lot of kind of scaffolding around the values that are at the centre of that mindset and the vision for the city, and scaffolds around that kind of pattern of behaviour between the values and the vision, which allow schools to apply it as a universal approach in a way that becomes tailored more and more over time, which I think that is so important, to taking it from a nice idea to something which is both transformative and pragmatic for the schools and the families and the young people that we're working with. And it sounds, it's just kind of ticking a lot of boxes in my mind when I think about the kind of systemic work that I'm trying to work with in my sort of traded patch in my day-to-day work, is that it is important to have those visions for what you want to achieve and the values, but also that common language and processes which scaffold each other over time. So that's been a very comprehensive overview of what it looks like in Glasgow. In terms of the stuff that you do day to day as an EP, it sounds like it's a helpful kind of reference point for what you do and how you frame what you do. Would that be true?
Absolutely. I think it runs through the heart of, as you say, Larissa, in terms of our consultation, assessment, thinking developmentally, and views, experiences of transition, etc., planning for meeting people needs, research functions. So it's part of our strategic and development focus, but also our kind of direct casework, development work with schools.
And also, and training. I guess, where we've got the Nurture City Lead Group, we've also got many other city lead groups. You know, Glasgow is a big authority, and, you know, in terms of our approach to supporting meeting the needs of our children, young people, and understanding our context. And I guess, you know, we have our, you know, speech, language and communication needs group, we have our restorative approaches, our solution oriented approaches group, so, you know, our one just thinking about care experience, children, young people, all of
and
these
how it relates with all mental of these health.
With the mental health and well-being, you know, our nurture is a big umbrella, I guess, and feeds through lots of those, all of that work, I guess. So it's kind of embedded within all of the work that all of our EPs do within the service at various different levels as well. And also then, you know, within the, you know, embedding within our establishments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess another thing that kind of popped into my head as you were talking there was, I guess, one of my reflections on the use of nurture group tools, particularly the Voxel profile, is that it was really helpful for understanding the needs and experiences of the young person that we were working with. But what I found was, and the reason that I perhaps stopped using the Boxer profile is because I was doing it kind of in isolation in some respects, trying to get nurture as an idea off the ground, is that it kind of fed into a sort of labeling way of kind of processing what needs children had, and therefore they need to be set in a certain way or kind of integrated or included in a different way, which wasn't in line with the nurture principles, if that makes sense. So how do you make sure, because it sounds like there's lots of support around the systems, the schools, the local authority, all of those sort of things. How do you ensure that it meets the needs of the children and the families, and how do you talk to them about nurture as an idea?
I think that can be a tension, Tim. I know we've certainly reflected in the past on discussions what at the point where a child is maybe identified as someone who could benefit from the experience of targeted nurture, how that discussion is taken forward with the family, the use of the language of nurture itself, because that comes back to one of the key principles, the importance of language as a vital means of communication, and thinking that everything we deliver is within the context of supportive relationships. So I would say it really has to come back to that supportive ethos, whereby there is a trusting relationship between school staff and families. And Larissa, I know you've been very involved in the kind of parental engagement or family engagement strand, because again, it's thinking compassionately, isn't it? And the last thing we would want is for families to feel that, you know, your child requires nurture or has perhaps missed some developmental experiences, or attaching any sort of stigma or blame to the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess as well, where you're reflecting on that use of data and things, and using data from a Boxall profile in terms of using that information to help inform targets, or, you know, kind of areas for development, that focus, you know, focus work within nurture groups. I think that sometimes there can be misconceptions about the data from the Boxall profile and how that could be used. Maybe that you were touching there, Tim, in terms of we do this and that's the driver then for that academic attainment, or in terms of what the child needs. And I guess that whole school approach in terms of thinking about impact is about us building capacity within the workforce in order to be able to use and understand tools kind of appropriately and use them, building their capacity and knowledge, you know, thinking about having conversations with parents. Some of them might be difficult conversations, but using our psychology and our skills and sharing that with others to support them in having those conversations, you know, as part of those kind of nurturing communities. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that leads on to I guess the next point that we wanted to talk about is kind of how this approach can benefit staff and staff well-being, because I guess having that common framework, the common language, the common kind of values to reference when you're working with educators within the systems that they work, is really helpful. But there are some direct benefits for staff. Are there not?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, as we've touched on with so many strands of our key kind of work plan, currently staff wellbeing has been a key part of Glasgow's nurturing approaches and strategic focus prior to the pandemic, but this has taken on an ever more renewed importance, increased sort of significance over the past 2 years. And as I mentioned previously, it's also been an area of my own personal and professional interest due to my previous thesis research whilst I was in Southampton. It really does draw on kind of strengths-based approaches, and we've embedded a sort of positive psychology focus within that to build on existing good practice and what staff are telling us that they feel works in their context and what's supportive. So it's been integral. Again, as I say, it was already part of our thinking and our planning and our delivery, but it's really been integral to supporting the process of reconnection and recovery, and reinforcing that idea that staff can't effectively meet the needs of the children and young people and families that they support without first considering their own wellbeing needs, and the idea that you can't pour from an empty cup, and to do that effectively. So our aims, I suppose, within that, if it's helpful just to share, is I suppose was really to provide information and support to staff that was practical and accessible and psychologically informed, and to establish supportive spaces for individual and shared reflection. Over the course of the pandemic, I think we've seen an increase in third sector supports as well. So the likes of Bernardo's, Places to Be, also really recognising the importance of those psychologically safe supervision spaces for staff, really. So that was another key aim, and to create opportunities, as I say, in line with a strengths-based approach to strengthen existing support networks and to build the resilience of all of our staff, not just teaching staff, I suppose, support staff as well. So really the way that we've implemented that is working very closely in collaboration with our Nurture Development Officer. And that's involved a whole range of work, starting from an initial needs analysis and recognition of staff wellbeing needs. And that's obviously ongoing, as we say, through our annual Nurture survey or conference discussions and feedback. We did deliver an initial pilot back in 2018, which involved staff wellbeing groups specifically for Nurture coordinators and practitioners. And that was really positively evaluated in terms of supporting both the wellbeing needs of the participants, and also it showed a positive impact on their own self-reported feelings of self-efficacy as a teacher. And as Larissa mentioned, we don't tend to deliver one-off training inputs. So that's all with the view to supporting sustainability. So the idea behind that was that it would be a cascade. It was designed as a cascade model, where staff could discuss ideas or strategies to share within their wider staff teams and then take that back to roll out within their establishment. A few of the other ways that we've kind of rolled that out across the sector is input to new and aspiring head teachers as part of local authority leadership program. And we've also facilitated peer supervision structures for head teachers, recognising their unique wellbeing needs as school leaders. And running throughout all of that, I suppose coming back to some of the theory, it's that recognition of the impact of vicarious trauma within the profession, particularly within the context, the challenging context that staff are working within. And again, we mentioned compassion seems to be a kind of key theme from today, but the seconded post that one of our colleagues contributed to developed a suite of professional learning resources, which is referred to as the Compassionate and Connected Classroom or Community. So this involved modules to support staff wellbeing again, looking at wellbeing within a sort of trauma-informed lens, and again using that model of practitioner inquiry to really embed any further work within the establishment context. And most recently, just to bring it up to the current sort of situation, we have we already had a range of materials to support staff wellbeing sessions, both at the establishment level and across Nurture practitioners, but we adapted these to respond to the pandemic and school closures. So this involved a shift to online webinar modules, which I'm sure a lot of services had to respond quite quickly, but fortunately we had a lot of materials already in terms of responding to change, thinking about what supports reconnection and recovery. I'm just bringing it back to the language of Nurture and how that applies, really. So we have a Nurturing Ourselves resource pack, which staff can use independently or as a staff team to support individual or peer reflection, as well as online materials. But now we're able to increasingly deliver that kind of in person with staff teams. And finally, we've delivered input to early years managers, linking back with your sort of remits, Larissa, in terms of, I was blown away actually, staff were able to share a range of innovative approaches, and they've drawn on real sort of resourcefulness, creativity of staff to maintain that sense of connection during the most challenging circumstances. So actually what's come out of that is some lovely video examples that demonstrate practitioner voice or case study examples of effective practice and what is working in supporting staff wellbeing. So we have nice early years and primary sort of examples of how that's been implemented. So a whole host of work really, but again, I guess it's giving it that importance within the whole vision of becoming a nurturing city. We can't get that right unless we unless staff feel nurtured and supported, and that their voices are heard as well.
Yeah, I mean it's that kind of golden thread again of, you know, coming back to what Larissa said at the start about you can't do Bloom's until you've done Maslow. You know, I think this is a key selling point of this idea, is that you know, the way that we are as education professionals really does relay back to what our assumptions about what education's about. And if education doesn't involve that sort of nurture and secure base for its practitioners as well as its children, young people and families, then you are going to get, I guess what trauma-informed approaches might call kind of trauma-organized systems, where you have this real dissociation between what's being actually felt emotionally within the classroom, emotionally within a teacher's experience, and what their kind of what their job role is in terms of, you know, achieving certain grades for the children in their class. And it's something that I come across again and again, is this sense of, you know, trying to split staff well-being from kind of performance and grades and all of those sort of things, which I, you know, this helps me to think about that in a different way, and to come back to those principles that it's really important.
I think, you know, you're touching on that, Tim, in terms of looking at all of these different aspects as kind of discrete entities, makes it really difficult, you know, when they're actually so intertwined with that, and how we support that. And it, you know, also comes back to the nurture principles. Yes, we have six of them, but they're not discrete either, in terms of they all cross over. And, you know, thinking about, you know, children's developmental stage, and then what's their behavior communicating to us, how do we then shape our responses, what language do we use, and how do we support the, you know, you can't really separate them. And that kind of well-being one, you know, number three, almost for me feels like it pulls all of the other principles together. And I think that would kind of reflect at both kind of for the children and young people, but also for staff, you know, for other, you know, professional support in them, and for our families as well.
Yeah.
I think we're just trying to identify three kind of priority areas for discussion today. We were just recognizing the links, and essentially what we're talking about is how do we underpin and embed a nurturing approach for our learners, for our staff, and for our families, but trying to kind of separate out all of those elements has been really an interesting process of reflection for us, and kind of making all those links between the various elements and everybody's role within that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I mean, I guess, what are your experiences of, obviously we're looking at it from kind of like bird's eye view in a bit, but in terms of your experiences as practitioners in supporting staff, you know, what kind of thing would that look like on the ground for you guys?
I think it's encouraging that curiosity, whether, you know, at any stage about the language, the narrative that maybe is around a young person's needs.
And I guess, you know, in terms of thinking about well-being, we've had, I guess, coming back to the different levels, the different kind of like, you know, core functions and core work of an EP, you know, we've heard lots there about kind of like some of that research, that training, kind of interventions, things that might be in place for staff. Also, when we're linking with our schools, we're checking in with staff on the phone, doing that at an individual level. We also in Glasgow, we kind of requests for involvement to our service are made in a slightly different way, particularly reflecting on my experiences within the English context, and it's much more at a kind of group discussion level and then a multi-agency. So actually at those points we've kind of got groups of deputy head teachers or head teachers discussing children, but we also build that relationship with those kind of with our learning communities, I guess, because our schools are kind of grouped into learning communities. So we get to know staff. So we're doing it on that kind of individual consultation level, checking in with them. They're on the phone
all the time,
kind of on an informal basis rather than necessarily having kind of formal structures in place. It's also, I guess, supporting our, you know, kind of head teachers or, you know, members of senior management to think about what structures do they have in place within their system and their organization for supporting well-being for their staff, signposting them to the resources that are available. And then, as Fran was saying, they're getting some of that, you know, evaluation data and research data to kind of understand what's working, what they want more of, and using that to inform our kind of next steps.
Okay. We talk about right for every child. So schools are very experienced, I suppose, in planning around kind of key well-being indicators as well. So ensuring that children feel safe and healthy, active, responsible, respected, nurtured and included is really the kind of priority. So bringing it back to the language of that, but as you say, within a collaborative process that supports kind of staged intervention at the appropriate level
and is reflecting on, you know, the children, young people's well-being needs and on the staff well-being needs in meeting those needs, you know, particularly when we're thinking some the experiences of lots of our children as well and coming out from the pandemic, how that's impacted on kind of staff well-being and making sure that they've kind of got the supports and structures in place as well.
So top down and bottom up, really. I mean, we kind of talk about interrelated functions and the role of the EP in consultation and assessment and training and research and development. But I think back to that universal bit, isn't it? And when we talk about staged intervention, it's nurture for all. So whilst our aim is always to close that poverty-related attainment gap and ensure equity and focus on the needs of our most vulnerable learners and perhaps, you know, care experienced ASL sector, as we say, it's recognising how we can support school systems to meet the needs of all children and young people.
Yeah, and I guess that leads us on to that kind of the final ripple out into, you know, how we sustain this change in communities and with family engagement. So obviously kind of nurture as an idea does focus on the family unit to some extent and trying to promote that sort of approach and that secure base in the classroom, which we'd hope that you could develop in the family themselves. So what is the sort of kind of community facing aspect of this?
I guess that's the bit of work that we had started doing just before the pandemic hit. So with the pandemic coming along, it did kind of change the direction of travel. But I guess if we're thinking about, you know, our families and our communities, we know kind of, you know, kind of from Bronfenbrenner's ecological model that we don't exist in a vacuum. Children don't exist in a vacuum. And, you know, there's elements of the microsystem, the macrosystem, and that all influences, you know, children's development. And families and schools don't exist in isolation. So even though nurture work, you know, supports might be in place in school, if we're not nurturing our families as well, children equally spend a lot of their time at home and with their families. And that would, you know, would apply to their learning. It would apply to their well-being. And it's particularly over lockdown when there was lots of homeschooling and things going on. Actually, we kind of know from the research and the literature around family engagement or parental engagement, as it's often referred to in the kind of literature, that's just as important, if not one of the most important factors in helping to kind of drive forward, you know, raising attainment. And within our national improvement framework, parental engagement is recognised as one of kind of a number of key drivers. So that's kind of got a government focus as well and rippling down into education as something that schools need to be thinking about. They need to be driving. So we had started looking at this actually we were planning to start that with our colleagues who were maybe running nurture groups as part of their, you know, sort of CPD sessions. But then when the pandemic came, that changed our work at that point, and it also changed potentially how families were engaging with schools and vice versa. So that whole dynamic. And they've had to do things differently and be very resourceful and very creative at times, I think, to keep that engagement, be reactive and support the kind of emotional impacts of the pandemic on families as well. So what we had done is, you know, thinking about when we were moving to that recovery phase, you know, recognizing that there was that opportunity for reflection and learning within our service, within establishments, you know, with the hope that we could actually further strengthen parental engagement across the city and use something that was a really unique, hopefully something that we will, none of us will ever experience again in our lifetime situation in terms of that pandemic. But if we were getting something right then, or what was working, what could we take, what learning could we take from a very unique context and try and build on that going forwards? So that's really, I guess, what, you know, as Glasgow's striving to become that nurturing city, when we're keeping nurturing approaches at the heart of all of our work with partners, with our communities, it is about nurturing our staff, our families and our children and young people. So in terms of, you know, what we did, when we got towards the end of 2020, we sent out a survey to parents and carers across the city to gather their views and experiences of family engagement with establishments during lockdown. And I think we received just under 200 responses from parents, which we were a bit blown away by. We were expecting, maybe we had low expectations, but we were expecting around 20 responses. So when we got 200 in, it was a lot of data and a lot of feedback that parents had taken the time to share with us and wanted to share. And what we did was we kind of coded and themed all of those survey responses. So some of it was kind of key quantitative data just about, you know, methods of communication and things, but also about their experiences. And from that, we had five key areas, which were around home learning, communication, health and well-being, the curriculum and moving forward. So what would they like things to look like going forwards? And we wanted to further explore those using focus groups. So we also had some parents join us for focus groups, and this is where we were able to gather that more kind of rich, in-depth, qualitative data around family engagement during the pandemic. And from this, we have developed a set of best practice guidelines for our establishments in terms of going forwards. And I guess another aspect that we have done is in terms of a role for psychological services and thinking, how can we support our establishments? You know, if this is, if family engagement's a key driver, how can we be supporting them in terms of their learning and understanding around family engagement? So we've developed a workshop module for establishments around family engagement, which covers some of the key literature, so helping them to understand the why, which is really important if we're asking people or supporting them to implement things. It's knowing why they're doing something is really important part of that process. Thinking about our, you know, our kind of legislative context and landscape, sharing that research, but really crucially linking family engagement to each of the six nurture principles. So thinking about what does that mean for families. So at transition points, a lot of focus is on transitioning the child or young person, but what about transitioning the family? Those parents might have made a relationship, you know, within a primary school with a key member of staff, and that's coming to an end for them. How do we support that for a key member of staff within the high school that the child's going to? Thinking about what parents are communicating through their behaviours,
what their own experiences have been of education,
and that understanding, and getting them to think about kind of reflective activities again on what they're doing well, what they could be doing differently, and that action planning. And as part of the Applying Nurture as a Whole School Approach framework that Fran had touched upon earlier and the questionnaires that we were mentioning, there's one in there for parents and carers. So part of our role has been to just revise that and maybe think about some of the questions and tailor them a bit more, but also helping to promote to schools to gather views from parents and carers as part of their self-evaluation process around nurturing approaches. So this is very much something that's in progress and rolling out. We're also looking at it within the additional support for learning sector and thinking about ways in which we can develop maybe a short video or some materials that establishments could then use to explain nurturing approaches to our parents and carers so that they have that understanding. So I guess that's kind of next steps for pieces of ongoing work there.
And Larissa, you're planning to share that at our annual Nurture Conference in May as well. So that would be disseminated. Mm. That would be the main
area
forum for feeding that back.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds brilliant and awesome to do that. And I guess, you know, I guess my experience of, I guess, my small patch of schools where I work is that schools pivoted during the pandemic to, I guess, a more kind of compassion-focused way of engaging with parents and really trying to understand those things, which you could probably map on to those six principles of nurture, and understanding where people were at and understanding behaviors, communication, all of those sort of things. And I have seen a transition back to an old way of kind of being a more kind of, we're the experts, we kind of tell you what we're going to do, etc., as the sort of kind of cultural pressures have gone back onto attainment and all of those sort of things. But it's a really helpful way to think about not only the importance of parental engagement, but how a psychological framework like nurture can provide us with the principles and the prompts to think about what should we be thinking about when we are engaging with parents, and how should we do that, rather than just it being sort of information giving or information receiving.
That two-way kind of two-way communication and that consultative process, isn't it? But and I guess we know that it's not tokenistic consultation and thinking about our stakeholders. It's really trying to understand their experiences, their perspectives, you know, things that are difficult for them, you know, enablers for them as well, and then helping to build on that. And I guess with, you know, recognizing as well within that, that's, you know, lots of our staff were parents themselves throughout, you know, engaging in home learning and things in lockdown. So they kind of had a foot in both camps, I guess, in terms of that, you know, compassion. And that's just, that's it's a word that's really come out today, isn't it? In terms of that compassion and that understanding and that hope that we can learn from something that was really challenging situation for all of us and be able to move that forward in a positive way for the benefit of everybody.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I'm aware that I've taken quite a lot of both your time now, and think about drawing the conversation to conclusion. I mean, I guess from my perspective, in terms of thinking of nurture as a hopeful approach, I mean, there's definitely goals there. There's definitely values that guide those goals. And it sounds like Glasgow has taken huge efforts and a sustained effort to kind of scaffold things that are going to support those, and it seems like it's become a self-fulfilling nurturing sort of approach over time, which is expanding across kind of Bronfman Brenner's ideas of ecological systems, in the hope that it helps develop each one of those systems from the individual outwards into a more compassionate, hopeful place to live and to work and to learn as young people. From your perspective as practitioners who are kind of working at the heart of this, what do you think that other educators and educational psychologists could do to find out more about nurture and to implement this sort of thinking and practice in their day-to-day work?
I guess that the kind of, you know, thinking about that, you know, essence of nurture, like you were saying, Tim and Fran, about is that hope, that resilience, that recovery, you know, and thinking about us as agents of change and how we might want to help support others to understand. So, you know, something that we were thinking about as well is that, you know, as psychologists, we do have that kind of evidence base and that research, and using that to help share with others how we know something like nurture works and that approach, and seeing that in practice. And then you almost can start, we do it all the time, don't we? We sow seeds of change, we sow thoughts, we want to try and create that ripple effect and to empower others, I guess. It's also I think for us as well, thinking about that implementation. And you can't successfully implement interventions or larger kind of whole establishment approaches if you haven't got that kind of robust implementation framework. You know, it's psychologically informed. It's thinking about evaluation. It's thinking about needs analysis, thinking about, you know, that implementation team and that vision. And I think really for me, I think Fran's got a few references there for people to find out more. But just a kind of that kind of last message about having that importance of strategic relationships. So who are our key partners within our authorities? Where's our locus of control and things that we can change? And something that, you know, really resonates with me is it takes a village to raise a child. And I think when we think about nurture, I think that really rings true in terms of that proverb.
Fantastic. Yeah. I suppose agree with everything you've said, Larissa. It's needs led, isn't it? And it's a listening to the views of our children, young people, our families and our staff, and ensuring that they're involved. And it's often only sort of small changes, isn't it?
Yeah, starting smaller things.
Yeah, that makes such a big difference. For those who are interested in finding out more, we just wanted to highlight our Glasgow Educational Psychology Service website. That's a GLOW blog. And we also, if you wanted to follow us on Twitter, at Glasgow EPS, or as well as at Glasgow Nurture, and that would be our Nurture Development Officer as well. So we're really keen to share the work that we've been doing to continue to raise the profile of Nurture and to share the views of our stakeholders as well within that.
Awesome. And can people still, it is the conference that you're doing in May, is that an open conference or is that just a Glasgow thing?
Just within the, for it's a kind of a celebration conference for staff. Within staff, within establishments. But if people are interested in finding out more, you know, about the approach, from looking at it, and there's also the whole school framework that's really helpful and is freely available on the Education Scotland website, or if you just Google it. But we're very happy for people to get in touch with us if they would like, you know, to find out more. And we've got lots of colleagues in the service that, you know, we would be able to signpost.
And we have done that in the past, both north and south of the border, linked with interested
services. Done a bit of a skill swap session with different services and things.
That's been down beneficial.
On the south coast as well.
Yes.
Just to bring things all the way back full circle.
Well, thank you so much, guys. It's been a really interesting podcast. It's been really informative and really inspiring about, I guess, where a city and an EPS and EPs can get to, where there is that kind of cohesive push towards compassion and for their city to be a good place for children to live in, which I think are both very good things. So I will thank you very much from myself and all the listeners, and I'll stop the podcast there if that's okay.
Thank you.